Sometimes it's easy to forget that philosophers now long dead once had families, a world beyond the cocoon of their thinking and writing, a life with all the joy and sadness and conflict that a family can provide. I'm Alan Saunders, and today on the Philosopher's Zone, the family of the great Viennese philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. Huge wealth and privilege, multiple suicides, estranged siblings, and a general unhappiness were all features of life for the large Wittgenstein clan. These days, I think we might describe them as seriously dysfunctional. Ludwig himself, born at the end of the 19th century, was an important figure for the group of philosophers and mathematicians known as the Vienna Circle. For them, though he wasn't one of their members, he wasn't a joiner, and he was described by his older contemporary, the philosopher Bertrand Russell, as the most perfect example I have ever known of genius as traditionally conceived, passionate, profound, intense, and dominating. Russell knew Wittgenstein at the time of his only published work, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, of a work of formal logic. The later book associated with Wittgenstein, The Philosophical Investigations, is a collection of notes, and he moves in that from formality to the informal language of everyday life. Well, Alexander Waugh is the author of a new book, The House of Wittgenstein, A Family at War, and I'm delighted to welcome him now to the Philosopher's Zone. Alexander Waugh, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the patriarch, Carl Wittgenstein. By all accounts, a very dominating personality. How did he shape the Wittgenstein family life?
Carl Wittgenstein was an odd man. He was the fifth child of eight, quite a prosperous father who was a wool merchant to start off with, but who gave him nothing. So Carl Wittgenstein went out into the world, ostensibly told to make it himself. He went as a young boy to America, where he worked in a bar, and where he got dysentery, and he did a lot of lowly jobs, including playing the fiddle in a little band, and came back to the disgust of his parents because he had actually run away from home. And so they thought he was essentially a loser. But he was a very strong-headed man, and he got himself a job working as an engineer in a rolling mill. And by cleverness, by guile, but not totally by... He married a lady who had a little bit of money, and he pumped her money into buying some shares, and soon found himself absolutely dominating the whole iron and steel industry of Austria and that part of Europe, and became a very, very rich man indeed. Now, he had eight children. Ludwig, you've discussed, the philosopher. Ludwig was the youngest of those children. The son just older than Ludwig was called Paul Wittgenstein, and he wanted to be a pianist more than anything in the world. And then the three older brothers all committed suicide. Now, it's thought that one of the reasons they committed suicide was they were appalled by the great pressure that Carl Wittgenstein put upon them to be just like him, to be engineers, to be entrepreneurs, etc. And this always happens. It's a very common phenomenon. A man makes a huge amount of money and expects his sons to do exactly the same. But the situations are different. The sons are differently constituted. They have money, so why should they go and be entrepreneurs? And it led to real pressure and real disasters.
Yes, I mean, like many self-made people, Carl Wittgenstein had strong ideas about, as you say, what constitutes a worthwhile life, and indeed the role of the individual. I mean, one critic described him as an autocrat who bled his workers dry. So that's before he even gets started on his family.
Well, there are various different stories. I mean, the stories that come down from the family are obviously slightly different to that. They describe him as being extremely generous. To anyone, certainly, he was competent. He was a good employer, and he showered them with cigars and presents and such like. But it is certainly true that he annoyed the workers' movement, which eventually merged into a sort of communist movement, and he was an exploiter. There's no doubt about that. He bought factories and was very keen on synergy, if that's the correct word. That is to say, he would buy not only the mine that dug up the metal, but he would also buy the place where the rolling mill, where the metal is treated. He would also buy the scythe factory, so he owned the whole process right along the line. Anyway, he did make a huge amount of money and was accused at the time of running cartels and pushing the price up of things. As far as the children go, it's interesting to know that because he had made his own way, another madness of self-made people, and he hadn't had a very good education because he had run away from school, he decided that school was of no interest to his children and that all you needed to know was a little bit of maths and a little bit of Latin and then you'd get by. So most of the elder children never went to school. This might be another reason why they committed suicide, because they were extremely lonely. I mean, school, apart from being a place to learn, is a very good place to meet other people and get to muck in and make friends and, albeit be bullied, but bully back or whatever it is, whereas those children were cloistered away and therefore couldn't really get on with other people. The two younger ones, after two of them had committed suicide, Karl Wittgenstein changed his mind so that Ludwig and his brother Paul, the young ones, were sent to school. Ludwig famously, of course, went to school in Linz with Adolf Hitler, and Paul went to another school just outside Vienna, Gymnasium.
And yet Karl, despite this austere manner, was a great lover of music, wasn't he? Even though he didn't want his children to become musicians professionally.
He was obsessional about music. He played the violin, he played the bugle, and above all, because he was a rich patriarch, he was able to shower money on Viennese musicians, and of course Vienna was the musical capital of the world, so that he had in his house as guests and people giving concerts, including Mahler, Richard Strauss. Brahms was a close friend who came and heard his clarinet sonata played in the Wittgenstein Palais for the first time. And he also collected musical manuscripts, and on the tables to left and right in the drawing room, the music scattered all over the place, I gather, were manuscripts of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, of Mozart symphonies and concertos and Schubert songs, the Trout Quintet, the Eine kleine Nachtmusik. They just collected them up and had them lying about, hundreds of them. The children were all extremely musical, but they were not encouraged to be musicians. If they said, "I want to be a pianist," the answer was, "No, you don't do that. That is too low a class. You'll do what I tell you to do. No child of mine goes on the stage."
His wife, Leopolda, who seems to have been rather unlike Karl, rather reserved, perhaps somewhat nervous, but she seems to have been only truly happy when she was playing the piano.
She was extremely nervous and, according to some accounts, couldn't really understand a long or complicated sentence and hated argument and was very edgy. And she sat down at the piano and suddenly, according to everybody, became herself. This was interesting because I think it meant that the children actually only really communicated with her through music. They played duets with her, they sang with her, and that's when they loved her. At all other times, they found her rather irritating.
So would it be reasonable to say that music was the glue that kept the clan together, insofar as they were together?
I would say precisely that. It was exactly what kept them together. And once again, very mixed messages came out of that. I mean, if you look at the case of Paul Wittgenstein, he was the one who said he really wanted to be a pianist. And the father said, "No, you don't do that." So he had to wait until his father died. He had a lot of money then, and he simply hired the best hall in Vienna, the best orchestra, the best conductor, and sat down and said, "Right, come on, audience." And the audience had to be made up largely of their servants and tenants because nobody had heard of him, and he played them all four piano concertos in a row. But he couldn't do it until after his father's death. One of his elder brothers who committed suicide actually wanted to be an actor, and once again that was considered not good enough, was sent by his father to read chemistry in Berlin, where I suspect from the laboratories he stole a little phial of cyanide, went into a bar in Berlin and ordered two glasses of milk, tipped the cyanide into one of them, asked the pianist to play one of his favourite songs, and as it got to its climax, he swallowed down the cyanide and collapsed on the floor. Again, a mixture of paternal pressure and, I'd say, very mixed messages about music and the arts.
Well, indeed. Your book, of course, places a considerable amount of emphasis on Paul, who, during the time of Ludwig, I mean, Ludwig is now, his name is now mentioned in the same breath as Plato or Kant, but during their lives, he was much the more famous of the Wittgenstein children. Was it because of this fame and because he is less well known now that you decided to concentrate so much on him?
It was partly that. There are other factors. One is that I consider myself a bit of an expert about writing about families, since I've written about my own family and it proved quite successful. And families are really what interests me. In fact, one can look at the biographies of nearly all famous men and women for that matter and rewrite them from the family angle. I think there's a general tendency to decide once the person's hit their career, we'll just forget about the family. But of course, you can't do that. And that this was a particularly interesting family, that Ludwig, the youngest, actually shuddered at the thought of his family and pretty well deserted them. He went to live in Cambridge. He bought himself a little house up in Norway. So he essentially wrote himself out of the story. That the three older brothers, as I've said, committed suicide, which left Paul really the head of the family, and therefore all the family business, if you like, could be seen through his eyes. So that was one reason why I did it. The other reason is I am essentially musical. I read music at university, and Paul, being a concert pianist, very interesting one, because as we haven't mentioned yet, but he lost his right arm and made a huge career just playing with his left hand. And so I thought that would make a very interesting story.
You mentioned that Paul Wittgenstein lost an arm in World War I, but continued to play the piano. He commissioned composers to write works for piano one hand, including Ravel's Concerto for the left hand. Was that, do you think, why he was famous as a pianist, that he was this sort of oddity, this one-handed pianist? Or if he'd kept both arms, would he still have been highly regarded and very well known as a pianist?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Ludwig hated going to hear his brother play in concerts because he felt very much that the audiences were pitching up to look at a circus freak. But we have to remember the following thing. When he had two hands as a pianist, which wasn't for very long, his father died in December 1913, and Paul immediately scrabbled together a concert, and the war, of course, broke out in July, and he had his right arm off in August. So there was only a tiny window when we can judge him as a two-handed pianist. But when he had those two hands, he did about four or five concerts that got a bunch of phenomenal reviews. I mean, they said he was a really serious, sensitive artist with a phenomenal technique. Now, why I think you possibly asked that question is because there are recordings that exist of Paul Wittgenstein that are not terribly good. And it's easy to think, well, he had a lot of money, he bought himself into the thing, and then he had one hand, so everybody felt sorry for him. But actually, he was a pretty crappy pianist. I would say that what happened is he went on too long. He was a very nervous character, and playing the piano with one hand, you may think that that's half as difficult as playing with two hands if you're only playing with one. I assure you, because I've done a lot of it, it is six times more difficult to play the piano with one hand than with two. And I put a huge nervous strain on him. He was a very nervous person. A lot of things went wrong in his life. And he was very fearless. He wasn't a show-off, but he was fearless. And if he had a fear, such as getting on a concert stage, he said, I'm going to have to conquer it. And so he just went on playing the piano, and he should have stopped.
Alexander Waugh, our guest this week on The Philosopher's Zone. We're talking about the family of the great Viennese philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. And in case you were wondering, here's a little of Paul Wittgenstein playing one of the works he commissioned after losing his hand in the war, Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand in D major. The sound quality's not the greatest, but you get the idea. Paul Wittgenstein was in fact the first person to perform Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand, playing it with the Vienna Symphony Orchestra in 1932. Now you might say that as a pianist losing a hand and then learning to play with just the one hand, he displayed the kind of iron will demonstrated by the family's patriarch, Karl. And perhaps you could say that Ludwig displayed iron will of a different kind. So would it be fair to say that Karl's genes were passed on to the two youngest brothers, perhaps skipping the other Wittgenstein children?
Well, that depends to a certain degree on how you look upon suicide. I would say that suicide demonstrates a pretty iron will myself. I think they all were extremely iron-willed. And I think what's interesting about this story is we've grown up with the idea of Ludwig being extremely eccentric and strong-minded. For instance, he gave away all his money, and we've said he was a multimillionaire. He gave the whole lot away after the war. He didn't want to have any of it. He also did something very odd, which, this is Ludwig, which is he went to his commanding officer during the war and said, I wish to be placed in a more dangerous situation so that I can be shot upon, because I really want to know what it feels like being about to die or being threatened with death. Now, what interested me is to find that Paul had done exactly the same thing in the war. He also went to his commanding officer and said, this isn't good enough. I want to be really in a dangerous position. They were fierce patriots, all the Wittgensteins, and I think that's something to do with it too.
Now, as you said, it looks as though Ludwig was at school with Adolf Hitler, though I think they were in different years. And, of course, the Nazis and the question of cultural identity and the family's Jewish ancestry did have a big impact on them, didn't it?
It pretty well destroyed the family that had been very badly maimed already by the First World War. Then along came the Second World War, but before we actually get to the war, we have Anschluss, which you know means the annexation of Austria by the Germans, and a great deal of problem when the Germans decide that the Wittgensteins are Jews. And the Wittgensteins hadn't really considered themselves Jews in the sense that all their grandparents were baptized Christians and they'd been brought up in the Catholic faith. And it came as a bit of a shock and as a surprise. Paul managed to escape out of Austria, but left behind were two of his sisters. And this is where the story gets extremely interesting, because they had a huge pile of gold sitting in a Swiss bank vault, which belonged to all the siblings. That capital could only be released if all siblings signed it off. Nazis, as we know, love more than anything in the world gold, and when they got whiff of this gold, they said, right, we want it. Paul was outside of Austria and said, I don't see why I should sign this gold off. The two girls remaining said, we could be in trouble if you don't. The Nazis then came up with an extraordinary scheme, saying, if you give us the gold, we will classify you as Mischling, that is to say, half-breed. If you don't give us the gold, these two sisters will be classified as full Jews. Now, this created the most extraordinary tense moral drama, which ended with which none of the children ever spoke to each other again. So Ludwig Wittgenstein did not speak to his brother, who died in 1961, didn't speak to his brother after 1939, and nor did his brother speak to any of the sisters, because the sisters said, you're putting our lives at risk by not signing this. His argument was clear. He said, why should we give this gold to the Nazis? We cannot trust them. We can hand the gold over, but they can change their minds the next minute and treat you as Jews. What you must do is get out of the country. But the sisters were proud. They said, we are proud Austrians. We don't want to get out of the country. So there was a stalemate.
So that was Paul. What about Ludwig?
Ludwig, as I said, had given away all his money, but he still had a kind of advisory role and was partly a director on one of these trusts. So he came over first to Switzerland, he went to America, he also went to Berlin. Ludwig had got English citizenship. Of course, he wouldn't have entered Austria otherwise, or they would have trapped him there and not let him out. But once he had his English passport, he got into the ruckus and tried to help, not particularly on the side of his sisters or on his brother, but as a sort of mediator. He tried to solve the thing, but was, I'm afraid to say, pretty useless.
Do we know, as I said, only one philosophical work of Ludwig's was published in his lifetime. Did the family have any opinion about that side of him at all?
Paul Wittgenstein called Ludwig's work Schmarren, what you might call rubbish in German, and thought it was a waste of time, essentially. Ludwig equally thought that Paul's piano playing was a waste of time, so that was shared. The sisters adored Ludwig, but I get the impression, because he was very much the youngest, it was almost as a little toy, a teddy bear, a lucky mascot. They liked to look after him and cuddle him and treat him and say, we've got this little genius son. But they certainly didn't understand it. And in fact, what I think is very interesting about the whole Ludwig Wittgenstein story is that very few people actually understood Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophy. I'm talking about the Tractatus, which was published in the early 20s. And that includes Bertrand Russell, who you earlier quoted as saying that he was pure, unalloyed genius. He couldn't understand it, nor could Gottlob Frege, who was the great logician in Germany, nor could Moore, who was the very famous philosopher in Cambridge. Some of them said, well, when Ludwig tries to explain it to us, we think we can understand it, but when, the minute we're out of his company, we certainly can't understand it again. And there were times when Ludwig himself found it terribly, terribly difficult to understand and wondered himself whether he actually understood it. So I think that Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophy should be seen through that lens a bit more than it is.
He read Tolstoy, was inspired by Tolstoy with a notion of leading a good and indeed a holy and certainly a simple life. Do you think we should see that as arising out of a reaction against his family circumstances?
I think that's certainly possible, and it's certainly true that it was reading of Tolstoy and what he particularly loved of Tolstoy. This was during the First World War. He walked into a bookshop and there was only one book, and that book was Tolstoy's redaction of the New Testament. And Ludwig, who was quite mad, I have to say, saw that as almost a supernatural sign that this book was intended for him in some special way, and he walked around with it wherever he went during the war and was known as the man with the Gospels under his arm by his fellow soldiers. And he took this book very seriously, and it was that book, of course, that caused him to give up all his money. Jesus said, give up your money. And so the first thing he did when he got out of his prison camp in Monte Cassino was go to his bank and say, get rid of it all. And again, I think it was that book that made him think that his family was vulgar, troublesome, far too rich, etc., and certainly led him away from his family and more towards an ascetic life.
Well, he was at times lonely and at times very unhappy and even suicidal, yet his last words seem to have been that he'd had a wonderful life.
I go along with Nietzsche on this. I think the deathbed is an area for general showing off, and I would suggest that was a bit of pantomime. At the point of dying, he may have been able to look back and say, well, I did have a wonderful life. It may have been the appropriate thing to say to Mrs. Bevan, who was by his bedside at the time. But I wouldn't take that too seriously. He had a very troubled life and was always very close to suicide and thoughts of suicide. And if he wasn't thinking of suicide, he was thinking he was going to die from some disease. So that can't have been very happy. He was also very troubled about his philosophy and troubled that people seemed to fail to understand it, including himself. He was very troubled about his connection with his family, about his relationship with Paul, which was completely broken up. So there were a lot of reasons why he was not a generally happy man, and I think we can look at his life, and regardless of what he said on his deathbed, say it was a pretty difficult life.
Well, an unhappy man, and despite fabulous wealth, an unhappy family. The House of Wittgenstein, A Family at War by Alexander Waugh. You'll find details on our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. And I've been talking about the Wittgensteins with Alexander Waugh. Alexander, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today's programme was produced by Kyla Slaven with sound engineering courtesy of Charlie McCune. To take us out, a little more of the most famous piano work commissioned by Paul Wittgenstein, Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand. At the keyboard is the French pianist Jacques Février, who was personally chosen by Ravel to perform the work as soon as Paul Wittgenstein's 6-year exclusive performance rights expired. Hope you can join us next week. Bye for now.
We trust you've enjoyed this ABC Radio National podcast. Head back to our website for a range of programs you might also find of interest, including one of the longest-running programs on Australian radio, The Science Show with Robin Williams, a weekly measure of insights into all manner of scientific issues, debates, personalities, frauds, and, of course, discoveries. The Science Show is a program about ideas, not simply facts or bits of boffinry, and you can stream or download it at the Radio National website.